Chapter 29. Back at my apartment, I called Murphy on her personal cell phone. I used simple sentences and told her everything. "Dear God," Murphy said. "Can I summarize or what? They can infect the city with this curse thing?" "Looks like," I said. "How can I help?" "We've got to keep them from getting it into the air. They won't be on public transportation. Find out if any chartered planes are taking off between 7 and 8:30. Helicopters, too." "Hang on," Murphy said. I heard computer keys clicking. Murphy saying something to someone, a police radio. A moment later, she said, voice tense, "There's trouble."
"Yeah?"
"There are a pair of detectives heading out to arrest you. Looks like homicide wants you for questioning. There's no warrant listed." "Crap." I took a deep breath. "Rudolph?" "Brown-nosing rat," Murphy muttered. "Harry, they're almost to your place. You've only got a few minutes." "Can you decoy them? Get some manpower to the airport?"
"I don't know," Murphy said. "I'm supposed to be a mile from this case, and it isn't as though I can announce the terrorists are about to use a biological weapon on the city."
"Use Rudolph," I said. "Tell him off the record that I said the Shroud is leaving town on a chartered flight from the airport. Let him take the heat for it if they don't find anything." Murphy let out a harsh little laugh. "There are times when you can be a clever man, Harry. It takes me by surprise."
"Why, thank you. What else can I do?"
I told her.
"You're kidding."
"No, we may need the manpower, and SI's out of this one."
"Just when I had hope for your intelligence, too."
"You'll do it?"
"Yeah, can't promise anything, but I'll do it."
"Get moving. They're less than 5 minutes away."
"Gone. Thank you, Murph."
I hung up the phone, opened my closet, and dug into a couple of old cardboard boxes I kept at the back until I found my old canvas duster. It was battered and torn in a couple of places, but it was clean. It didn't have the same reassuring weight as the leather duster, but it did more to hide my gun than my jacket. And it made me look cool. Well, maybe cooler, anyway. I grabbed my things, locked up my place behind me, and got into Martin's rental car. Martin wasn't in it. Susan sat behind the wheel.
"Hurry," I said. She nodded and pulled out.
A few minutes later, no one had pulled us over.
"I take it Martin isn't helping."
Susan shook her head.
"No, he said he had other duties that took precedence. He said that I did too."
"What'd you say?"
"That he was a narrow-minded, hidebound, anachronistic, egotistical bastard."
"No wonder he likes you." Susan smiled a little and said,
"The fellowship is his life. He serves a cause."
"What is it to you?" I asked. Susan remained silent for a long time as we drove across town.
"How did it go?"
"We caught the imposter. He told us where the bad guys would be later tonight."
"What did you do with him?"
I told her. She looked at me for a while and then said,
"Are you all right?"
"Fine."
"You don't look fine."
"It's done."
"But are you all right?"
I shrugged. "I don't know. I'm glad you didn't see it." Susan asked,
"Oh, why?"
"You're a girl. Beating up bad guys is a boy thing."
"Chauvinist pig," Susan said.
"Yeah, I get it from Murphy. She's a bad influence." We hit the first traffic sign directing us toward the stadium, and Susan asked,
"Do you really think you can win?"
"Yeah. Hell, Ortega's only the third or fourth most disturbing thing I've tangled with today."
"But even if you do win, what does it change?"
"Me getting killed now? That way I get to be killed later tonight instead." Susan laughed. There was nothing happy in it.
"You don't deserve a life like this."
I squinted my eyes and made my voice gravelly.
"Deserves got nothing.
So help me, God, if you quote Clint Eastwood at me, I'm wrapping this car around a telephone pole."
"Do you feel lucky, punk?"
I smiled and turned my left hand palm up. I felt her hand settle lightly on mine a moment later, and she said,
"A girl's gotta draw the line somewhere."
We rode the rest of the way to the stadium in silence, holding hands. I had never been to Wrigley when it was empty. That wasn't really the point of a stadium. You went there to be among about a bajillion people and see something happen. This time, with acres and acres of unoccupied asphalt, the stadium at its center looked huge, and somehow more skeletal than when it was filled with vehicles and cheering thousands. The wind sighed through the stadium, gusting, whistling, and moaning.
Twilight had fallen, and the unlit street lamps cast spidery shadows over the lots. Darkness gaped in the arches and doorways of the stadium, empty as the eyes of a skull.
"Thank God that it isn't too creepy or anything," I muttered.
"What now?" Susan asked. Another car pulled in behind us. I recognized it from McAnally's the night before. The car pulled up maybe 50 feet away and rolled to a stop. Ortega got out and leaned down to say something to the driver, a man with a dark complexion and amber-toned glasses. There were two more men in the back seat, though I couldn't see much of them. I was betting they were all Red Court. "Let's not look scared," I said, and got out of the car. I didn't look at Ortega, but drew out my staff with me, planted it on the ground, and stared at the stadium. The wind caught my coat and blew it back enough to show the gun on my hip now and again. I traded in my sweats for dark jeans and a black silk shirt. The Mongols, or somebody, wore silk shirts because they would catch arrows as they entered wounds and enable them to pull barbed arrowheads out without ripping their innards apart. I wasn't planning on getting shot with barbed arrows, but weirder things have happened. Susan got out and walked up to stand beside me. She stared at the stadium, too, and the wind blew her hair back the same way it did my coat.
"Very nice," she murmured, hardly moving her mouth. "That's a good look on you. Ortega's driver is about to wet his pants."
"You say the nicest things to me,"